We are going to be joined in a moment by Michael Zweig, who is a professor emeritus at Stony Brook University on Long Island. He's the former director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life, which I believe is also based at Stony Brook. He's the author of many articles on labor history, political economy, and class, including several I'll mention, The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret, 6 Points on Class, an article published in the Monthly Review, What's Class Got to Do with It, American Society in the 21st Century. And Michael is also a contributor to the WPKN Weekly Nightly News, actually, which is produced by Hazel Kahn and others. And Hazel, incidentally, sends her warm regards to Michael Zweig. So, Michael, please join us.
Thank you, and warm regards back to Hazel and to everybody at PKN. It's one of the great institutions of the country.
I appreciate hearing that. That's a good way to kick us off here. So we've invited you here tonight to talk about some really amazing developments in the labor movement. It seems that we're poised at these sort of two seemingly contradictory events. The case that was just argued before the Supreme Court that could effectively mean the end of the labor movement as we know it, which is, of course, Janus versus AFSCME, the acronym for
American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, affectionately known as AFSCME.
Yeah, pretty hard to pronounce, but shorter than the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Right.
So, so we have that going on, which could, as I said, be a mortal blow to the labor movement. But at the same time, we have this extraordinary wildcat strike by tens of thousands of teachers in West Virginia that seems to indicate quite the opposite trend, like a resurgent labor movement ready to fight to the finish, as they just did. They actually won a major victory, pay raises, a re-examination of the healthcare program that could result in help coming from there, but they got their 5% raise. So these two things are going on at the same time. We'd like your help tonight, Michael Zweig, in unpacking both these developments, and we'd also like you to try to place them in the context of the broad sweep of the history of the American labor movement during the 20th century and going forward to the current day. So why don't we start with the Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME. What is the crux of this case, and what are some of the things that are at stake for our labor unions and American working families across the board?
What's at stake is the health and the capacity of the labor movement in the public sector all across the country, and whether it can maintain its strength and increase its strength, or if it's going to be hobbled by the Supreme Court's decision. Janus is a school teacher in Illinois, and he has objected to the fact that his union, which is a public sector union in Illinois representing teachers, that he's objecting that his union is taking dues money from him, even though he doesn't want to be part of the union, and he's not a member of the union. He doesn't support the union. So he feels that if he is not a member of the union, he shouldn't have to pay dues. And the union is taking positions in its negotiation with the government about terms and conditions of employment that he doesn't agree with, and by being forced to pay dues, he is essentially being forced to speak through his union opinions and views that he doesn't agree with, and that violates his constitutional rights to free speech and his constitutional rights to his own privacy and his own individual capacity. The problem is that the union is required by law to represent him. So if the union negotiates a contract and gets a wage increase or gets a grievance procedure or gets a health benefit or whatever it is that the union negotiates, he is covered by that. He gets those benefits. Not only that, but if he has a problem with his school administration and feels that he has a grievance with the administration according to what the union contract says, well, then he can go to the union and ask that the union represent him in his claim against the administration. Even though he's not a member, the union is required by law to take that case on and to represent him honestly and fully, without regard to his being a member or not a member. So essentially, this is what's sometimes called the free rider problem, where what he wants to do is just take a free ride on the union and get whatever benefits, but not be required to support the union in getting those benefits. Now, to make one thing particularly plain, nothing in the union dues goes to political advocacy. The union in Illinois, and no public sector union anywhere in the country, takes its dues from its members and contributes to political campaigns or organizes lobbying efforts for some kind of legislation. None of that is ever paid for out of dues. So we aren't really talking about the situation where a member is being forced to contribute to some political campaign. What we're talking about is somebody being required to pay what are sometimes called fair share fees, sometimes called agency fees, to the union that is obligated to represent them. And so if the Supreme Court rules on Janus's side that he does not have to pay dues, he does not have to pay any support to the union, but the union has to represent him, what that means is that the union, of course, loses his dues and loses the dues of a lot of other people who will say, hey, why should I pay into the union if I'm going to get the benefits anyway? Here's an easy way to get a pay raise. I'll just take my dues money and take it home. So that will very deeply undermine the strength of the public sector unions, not only in Illinois, but it's the Supreme Court, so it's for the whole country. And it's a very, very dangerous situation, a very dangerous path that we're coming to. Now, I'll just say also that it isn't really quite a contradiction to what's going on in West Virginia. It's the government and the corporation's response to what's going on in Virginia, where there's a strong public sector union that has its strength from its membership. And what Janus wants to do is to undermine exactly that strength so that public sector workers will be weakened in their ability to carry on the kind of activities that we see and the militants that we see in West Virginia. That's really what's at stake.
So the way the tea leaves seem to be displaying themselves, it looks pretty grim here for the labor side of this fight in the Supreme Court. What kind of a blow is this to organized labor? Does this decision, in fact, have any impact on labor unions in the private sector or any fallout for the private sector unions? Will this really unravel what remains of the labor movement, which has declined from the high numbers in the 1950s and 60s down to the very low numbers that we have now? I believe it's single digits that are actually represented by unions in the country now.
Well, what we have is, as you say, a long slide in the strength and capacity of trade unions in the United States, in the public and in the private sector, from the high water mark in the 1950s when something like a third or 35% of all workers in the country were represented in collective bargaining by unions. Now it's around 12% for the total of private and public sector. But actually, for the first time a couple years ago, the public sector unions had more members than private sector unions, because the private sector has been just slaughtered off in its union membership by companies closing down, companies going overseas, companies breaking unions through long strikes. There are a lot of different ways in which private sector unions have been weakened, so that we now have a situation where the public sector unions are the strongest representation of working people in the country. And that's the American Federation of Teachers, it's AFSCME, it's a lot of places for the service employees, SEIU, who represent public sector workers, communications workers of America. So these are strong unions based in public sector. Now, what's going to happen is if these public sector unions are deeply weakened because of Janus, then they're going to be weaker in their political representation, not through dues, but through their other political funds. They're going to be weaker in their own states, and that means that states are more likely to go for what's called right-to-work laws, which do the same thing for the private sector as what Janus is trying to do in the public sector. So it does have consequences for the private sector through the weakening of public unions, will weaken the voice of labor in the political process in general. Again, not because of the dues, but because there will be fewer people and the unions will be more sort of scrambling just to do their basic tasks, and they won't have enough time or energy or resources to go on and fight for the labor movement as a whole when it comes to legislation at the state or at the national level, for that matter.
You know, perhaps it would be a good idea to spell out the specific purposes and functions of unions within our capitalist economy. I suspect there's a whole generation of young folks who are not really clear about this, given the dearth of labor coverage in our media and the very negative, often very negative views about unions that are expressed by mainstream opinion makers, so-called. You know, I mean, just the whole notion of what is collective bargaining, how did the industrial unions form, and what did they accomplish, and what is their potential for actually creating some income equality in our country?
Well, that's a long story and a long history, but why don't we just sort of deal first with what is a union? I've had students in the not too distant past who thought unions are just a company. It's just another corporation. It's just called a union instead of General Electric. No, it is a representation. It's a collective, a group, an organization that represents workers in their dealings with management. So if you don't have a union, you're on your own. Just as an individual going to your supervisor or going to HR or going to the management and saying, I need a raise, or I need some time off, or, you know, I've been treated badly by my foreman and I need some help, or there's some discrimination going on here, whatever it is, you are on your own. Now, everybody knows that if you're on your own, you're in a weaker position dealing with people with power than if you have other people to come with you. As the old saying goes, don't go out without a crew. So what we have in a union is the workers themselves getting together and selecting a representative that's their choice. It's not forced on them, it's not pushed on them. The workers themselves in that company or in that shop have an election, and they vote or to have a union or not. And if they vote to have a union, then the union is their representative. It's not a third party. It is just a collective representative of the workforce itself. That is what goes and talks to management and brings the membership often with them to the negotiation table or to a rally on behalf of somebody who's been badly treated or to get better health benefits or whatever the issue is. What a union does is it allows the workforce to act collectively in regard to the power of management. So that immediately makes each individual worker sort of more powerful through the union, through the collective effort of all the workers, and that's what unions do. Now, of course, because unions make workers more powerful, management doesn't want unions. So management does everything it can to undermine or to destroy, if they can, unions and make it difficult for workers to exercise any authority over their conditions, over their wages, over what happens in the plant. So that's what unions do.
That's great. And I think maybe you could talk a little bit about the system in which we function here. We have a system in which if you're negotiating with a municipality or a state, you know, you're a public worker, it's analogous to the private sector where there's a corporation or a private individual who owns the company, the means of production, whose goal is to extract as much profit from that operation as possible. And the workers are part of that equation. So when their labor is priced by management or by the owners, the management has it's like their natural imperative to try to get the lowest price for the labor. That's kind of my primitive notion of what capitalism is. And so unions are a way to try to level the playing field. At least that's my concept.
Well, yeah, level the playing field means you're not going in there by yourself, just as a single person to deal with the corporate institution or to deal with school board or to deal with the Department of Motor Vehicles or whatever your employer is, transportation department, what have you, you're going in as a collective force, and that does, in fact, level the playing field. So you have these unions which developed right from sort of from the beginning of capitalism, all the way in the United States back before the Civil War, there were unions, and then after the Civil War, when there was real industrialization started getting going, workers were pushed down, they had wage losses, they were suppressed in their ability to complain about their conditions, they were fired, they were mistreated by their employers. So they got together and formed unions. And without going through the whole long history, it's enough, I think, to say that there was an enormous pushback from management. This is all happening in the private sector. Public sector unions basically did not exist. But private sector unions were trying to exist. And they got into huge fights with management, often armed battles, where the management would bring in armed goons, armed agents, bring in the sheriff, bring in the police, bring in the army, the National Guard to crush and defeat strikes. It's interesting, in West Virginia, the local police authorities refused to act against the strike. The local sheriffs and the local police forces in many parts of West Virginia just wouldn't do it. They said, hey, that's my cousin. That's my sister-in-law is in that school. I'm not going to go in there and break that up. But in the 19th century and into the beginning through the first third of the 20th century, there was a lot of that kind of very sharp struggle. And in the Depression, in the 1930s, people started getting really worried. The people in government, people in Congress, President Roosevelt, they started getting really worried that all this unrest, all these strikes, all this upsurge in work, what they called labor unrest, was threatening to the country, to the stability of the country. It was thought to be communist and socialist or inspired, and we had to put a stop to that. There were fascist movements that were also threatening to the stability of the country. So there was a lot of fear among the ruling elites of the country that the whole place, with 25% unemployment and with all this labor unrest, was very unstable and something had to be done. And what they decided to do, among other things, in the New Deal, was to give government protection for the first time to workers to organize unions. And that's what the Wagner Act did, or the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. After 1934, a whole series of general strikes around the country, real militant strikes that shut down whole cities, like in Minneapolis or in San Francisco on the docks, and or all up and down the East Coast in the textile industry. Management said, okay, or at least they were forced to say, okay, let's leave workers the right to have a union and to bargain collectively, and the government is going to protect them. And institutions were set up, like the National Labor Relations Board, to organize elections and to protect workers from employers retaliating if they tried to organize a union. And in that period of the late 1930s into the 1940s, there was a huge upsurge in union organizing because workers want unions. And they went ahead with the protection of the government to organize them. Management never really accepted that. And over the last 70 years, there's been a steady attempt to roll back the authority and capacity of workers to organize unions and the power and the capacity of unions to do anything if the workers elect and select a union. So this thing with Janus is just another step in that long process of undoing the power that workers got in the Depression when they had all this militance and when they had all this capacity to really shut down industries. So they were given some rights, and those rights have been chipped away and chipped away and chipped away until today. We have the next stage of that, which is what we see in the Janus case.
So in the light of that perspective that you just provided, what do you make of this amazing, I think extraordinary event of more than 20,000 teachers who are, by the way, I believe in two separate unions there. So maybe tell us a little bit about how you think this happened and what it might foretell for the labor movement in general.
A wildcat strike, technically the definition is, if the workforce goes out on strike, even though their leadership or the contract disallows it or disapproves of it. So a wildcat strike is a strike that is not authorized by the top leadership of the union. Now, this has been called a wildcat strike, and I don't know whether it's true that the top leadership of the union has walked away from it. One thing I do know, for example, in New York State, I'm at Stony Brook. I'm a public employee, or was until I retired last year. But we're not allowed to strike. It's against the law for public employees in New York State to go on strike. Any public employee, not just state employees, but city employees as well. So if we go out on strike, the union is held responsible. The union, is, as an institution, can be fined millions of dollars. The leadership can be thrown in jail. So what might be the case, I don't know for a fact in Virginia, in West Virginia, but it may be that the union leadership has to say, as a matter of law, we don't want this strike, and that protects the union from being fined or and the union leadership from being imprisoned. The membership can go on strike against the will of the union leadership, who are perhaps giving them winks and nods and saying, it's fine, go on, just like the the local sheriff who says, that's my sister-in-law in that school, and I'm not going to bust up this strike, but I have to do something or other to sort of make it look like I'm doing something. And so I think that that may be why this is called a wildcat strike, because the top leadership has to say, don't do it, but the rank and file and the ordinary teachers and school aides and the people who are on strike are just saying, well, this is what we're doing. And, of course, if you've got a strike that is in every one of the 55 counties of West Virginia and is shutting down all the schools, and it is a signal to the people in West Virginia that, you know, let's stand up, let's actually fight for what we need and not put it off on somebody else like Donald Trump, but let's really fight right here, right now, in this school, in this town meeting, for what is a matter of life and death for our families in wage increases, in health benefits. You know, that's a powerful force, and I think that people around the country will look at that and say, hey, that's what can we do to reproduce those conditions? Unfortunately, the basic condition of a strike like that is oppression, is being treated terribly, is having the third lowest wages of teachers anywhere in the United States, of having terrible health coverage, that they need better improvements, and that is the fundamental underlying problem, and you wouldn't wish that on your on anybody, but that is in fact the condition that a lot of people are facing. And with Janus, if it goes the wrong way, if it goes against unions, more and more union workers and more public employees are going to be exactly in the position that those West Virginia teachers are in, and are going to take some lessons from it, let's hope.
Yeah, it is. It is just an incredible inspiration. So it's sort of like I don't know if you remember the movie Norma Rae. You know,
sure.
You know, just sort of this breath of power that comes from that movie. This is the kind of feeling I think that a lot of folks in the progressive movement are getting from this extraordinary event in West Virginia. And also, I think the object lesson is clear. I saw that one of the legislators yesterday getting up and pontificating about, we offered them 4%. What's wrong with that? That's 80% of what they asked for. I mean, come on. If you're an adult, you're going to compromise. The teacher said, no way. You know, I mean, we're not going to, first of all, we're not going to do it until we've seen the signed contract, the signed agreement. But second of all, no, we want the 5%. We're still going to be at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of wages for teachers. And they held out, and lo and behold, with that solidarity, they won the day.
Yep. It's a very important lesson. You know, your reference to 80% just reminded me of something about union representation in the countries that we were talking about before. It's around 12% for public and private sector together. But if you do polls, and people have done polls, and there are data and evidence to support what I'm going to say right now, about 60% of the American workforce would like to be in a union if there was one available. They're not opposed to being in a union. They don't think unions are terrible. They want to be in a union. They would like that. That's what they say. 60%. 12% are in unions. That means 80% of the people who want to be in a union are not in one. Now, why is that? That's because if you want to be in a union, you try to organize one, it's very, very difficult, because the protections that used to be in the law have been interpreted away in court decisions and by rulings from the National Labor Relations Board, increasingly friendly to business, so that you end up with a situation that 80% of the workers in the United States who want to be in a union can't be in one. Because of the resistance of management and the hostility of their local regulations and government. So that's a very powerful position for business to be in, and it's a signal, again, of the difficulty of the life and the difficulty of sort of realizing the aspirations of working people in the ordinary course of just life. So when the ordinary course of life breaks down, then you end up with extraordinary things like what's going on in West Virginia. And if we can figure out how to generate that around the country, well, then I think we'll have a situation that maybe will force management and their political representatives to treat workers in a better way.
Well, I want to thank you, Michael Zweig. This has been a really great conversation. Michael Zweig, Professor Emeritus at Stony Brook University, is former director of the Center for the Study of Working Class Life, author of many articles that we quoted before. And, Michael, let's do this again. I think there's so much more, the type of thing you were starting to get into there about the legal structures and the erosion of those structures and the role of the business-friendly courts in defeating the aspirations of working people in this country. This situation we're in now, as you said, has been evolving over many, many decades, and I think that progressives are now really trying to figure out how to make this a priority for activism so that we can reverse that slide.
Anytime. I'd be happy to talk to you, and happy to get some feedback somehow from the listeners, and to see what we can do to push along, make working people have a better life.
Thank you so much, Michael Zweig. We'll be in touch.
Okay, very good. Thanks to you, and thanks to WPKN.
Thank you very much. Michael Zweig joining us there from Long Island. He is Professor Emeritus at Stony Brook University.